Have you made an honest review? Jump onto fifthwrist.com and read real takes by real owners about their watches. And of course, get involved and write about what's on your wrist. Fifthwrist.com is your independent space to talk watches.
Welcome to the Independent Thinking Show for Fifth Wrist Radio. This is a place dedicated to showcasing the great people doing interesting things in the world of horology. My name is Roman, and with me is my friend and co-host Adam from Medium Watch. Hey Adam, how you doing?
Very well.
All right, this is like our third episode in a week that we're recording. Obviously, they won't all go out in 1 week, but I feel like you get to see me too much. If Roman is only good in small doses, I feel. My wife would agree as well. But no, it's
I'm embarrassed to admit this, but yes. I guess we had kind of a busy holiday break, and so now we're packing them in this week.
Well, we got to keep this podcast marriage alive and strong. No, that's good. Look, it's always good because I really like when we get to have a chat, because mostly when we get sit down to have a chat, we have a cool guest or two that we bring on the show. And this guest today we're about to introduce, really thanks to you for setting up this conversation.
And also to Ronnie Madvani. He helped facilitate the introduction as well. So we got to say thanks to Ronnie.
Yeah, friend of the show. And of course, welcome back anytime, Ronnie. Always a pleasure. But no, that's cool. No, good stuff. So let me try and introduce our guest. It's always hard when people have many talents. It's really hard to rattle things off. All right, so our guest today is Guy Gahari, probably better known as his Instagram handle at Murillo55. Or his business website is Classic Watches NY. And Guy sells unusual, cool, really stylish vintage watches. He also sells gems and jewelry as well. He's a bit of a style icon. He's also a photographer. He's a nature lover. He's a book author. He's a jazz aficionado. And look, I can go on. You could get a sense. He's a all-round interesting dude. So we're very glad to have him. So Guy, welcome to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. Actually, one of my dreams is to have a radio show in the future. So maybe this is just the beginning of getting my feet wet of being on a sort of a radio setting. So thank you for making this happen.
You can add that to your... You can add that to your growing media empire. That's awesome.
Yes. You already have 3 Instagram accounts.
All right. Look, one of the ways we tend to kick off the show, let's do a quick sort of wrist check, watch check, location check, and a drink check if you're having a drink as well. And then we can launch into it. How does that sound? Adam, maybe we'll go to you first.
Sounds great.
Sure. So I've got with me my Patek Philippe Golden Lips, which was the first Patek I added to my collection. And I wore it today because it has an unusual case shape. It's over 50 years old, and it reminds me of some of the stuff that Guy sells. And so I figured I would wear a nice, vintage, beautifully finished Patek to guide this conversation. My beverage of choice today, given that it's in the afternoon, is seltzer water, not too exciting. And I am near Boston, Massachusetts.
Lovely.
Roman?
Oh, I went similarly with... So I'm in Melbourne, Australia. I haven't been out of Melbourne for a little while. So I'm still stuck here for a little while. I also had a similar thought. Wrist checks, we try to match to what our guest might be interested in. People know me. I'm not much of a vintage guy. But I dredged up a couple of things. So the first thing I've got is a 1970s... sort of little shape watch. It's called the brand is called Dulux, which is really hard to Google because it's Dulux watches and you get all sorts of funny stuff. But it's a 1970s little sector dial, strong sort of Cartier vibes with Breguet hands. I'll send you a picture, but it's a nice little number. I also was in preparation for this episode. I was looking at Guy's Instagram account, Murillo55, which is always dangerous because there's always cool stuff there. So people do that, should definitely check it out. Do it at your own peril. And that Guy had this amazing Cartier skeleton pocket watch, which was just brilliant. So I thought, I'll try to bring a pocket watch to the game. Mine is not a minute repeater. Mine's not a Cartier either. But what I did manage to find in the watch box is a 1934 Breguet pocket watch. So this one came from an aristocratic family, because I've got a little extract from the thing from the Brege archives, and it's got a little family crest of the family. I know who the family is. I'm not going to say it here in case they want to have it back, and I'm not entirely sure. No, the ownership is not disputed. But I just thought, I've got a 1970s wristwatch and a 1934 pocket watch. So hopefully I've passed that. Hopefully we can maintain Guy's interest for the next little while. We've proven our cred. Drinks wise, Adam, you and I, we have trouble coordinating our time zone. So I'm in Melbourne. It's 7 a.m., 7:20 a.m. No alcohol, unfortunately. For me, it's just a Friday as well, so I can't really quite get away with that. So I'm just having a boring cup of tea. But I'll maybe, depending on how this conversation goes, maybe I'll add something to it to spike the tea a bit later. So if no one's looking. But that's me. All right, well, handball to Guy. So tell us, Guy, where are you? What's on the wrist, pocket, clock, whatever it is, and a beverage if you've got one?
I'm here in my office in Great Neck, Long Island, which is close to my home. I'm wearing on my right-hand wrist, that's where I wear my watch, on the right, Audemars Piguet stainless steel tonneau shape, unassuming watch with its bracelet, which has a really special technology that is easy to size, no need for links. Look how like I just slide it off. And I wore it because today is a rainy day here. I wear it on my casual days. It's a watch, one of the first watches I bought from my personal collection. And it's in imperfect conditions. That's why I like it, because it has a bit of a blemish on the dial, a bit of a water damage. But as they say in Italian, ogni scarafone bella mamma sua, each cockroach is nice for its own mom. I love this watch. As far as drink, I am drinking water because I don't drink alcohol anymore. I quit 3 years ago. Drink of choice typically is water, seltzer, coffee, or tea. And I got water with me today.
Sounds like a really dry conversation.
Hopefully not wit-wise, maybe beverage-wise. Oh, look, one of the ways we tend to start this conversation, guys, maybe tell our listeners who don't know you, maybe tell us a little bit about yourself, who you are, how you ended up doing what you're doing, handling really cool watches and things and working in the industry, if we can say, in inverted commas. But maybe give us a little bit of an introduction about who you are and where you're from.
My name is Guy Gohari. I'm 42 years old. I was born in Milan. I came to New York in 2002 at 21 years old. Little people know I came here with only $100 in my pocket and a suitcase and a job the next day. And that's how I started my road in this country as an immigrant, starting from nothing and pursuing really the American dream. When we were in Italy, I came from a prominent family at the time, but unfortunately the economic situation changed and my father had lost most of our assets. So I had no choice but to change place and start fresh. So I came to New York and I started working for my cousin, which offered me a job in her precious stone company. She was selling and dealing in rubies, sapphires, emeralds. And that was what my dad and I was doing when I first started working at 18 years old. We were selling precious stones to jewelers, manufacturers, etc. So I had that job here in New York set for me. And slowly I started working for my aunt, getting to know many jewelers across the country and across the world, and establishing myself in that industry. But really my passion was style and clothing, and I felt that my calling at the time was to be involved in the clothing industry. And the best way and idea for me was to become a custom clothier. So I found this company that started this business a year or two before I found them. And they were the fastest growing company at the time in the industry, called Astor and Black. And I became their salesperson, doing suits for private individuals, reaching them in their offices, their homes, and establishing now like a retail network of wealthy private individuals. I made suits for Fox News. I made suits for many real estate tycoons here in New York. So I got to meet a lot of people. And that was my true passion and my truest happiness in life. And I succeeded. But it was so demanding of me, and it was so involving and busy, and it was at the same time stressing me out. So I wanted to find something that would give me more joy without the stress and without the whole marriage to the suit and customer. I don't know how the idea came to me that watch collecting was something that needed to be explored. And a friend told me, hey, this older gentleman that is a friend of our family, he has some vintage watches and he's selling them. So I called immediately the guy and I said, I have some interest in doing something with vintage watches. That was about 10 years ago. And he consigned me about 6 Rolex Datejust 1601, 1603s. And on every suit appointment I had, I started showing these watches. And I sold 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And I saw I was going, and I was excited to start something fresh. So I approached the gentleman again. I said, listen, I think this could be something bigger. Why don't we partner up, and I'll bring my clientele from the suits, and you'll bring your funds and in the vintage watches, and we'll start like that. And so he thought I was crazy, because I really had a great thing going on with the suits, but I wasn't happy ultimately. To do something without joy and happiness is not doing it for me. I had succeeded in my dream, but it didn't bring me the fulfillment I wanted. So I left everything and I started again for the third time in my life. And at the time, believe, I was like already married and I had 3 kids. So I was taking a bit of a chance. And we took a booth on 47th Street and we started dealing with vintage watches. Rolex, Audemars, Pateks, things that we liked. And my partner at the time also was a very tasteful Italian man. So we always bought what we liked. We never abided to the trends, etc. We said, if we do this, we have to enjoy it. So we proposed only what we believed in and what we liked. And that's how I got into all these weird dress watches and design watches, because these are the things that I like and that I would wear. So that's how it started. And this is how we are here today, 10 years later.
Oh, wow. That's a real transformation. And do you think that there was something critical about being where you were, about being in New York, about being in Manhattan or in Long Island, that made this possible? Did location matter?
Absolutely. Location and connections, as my story says, matter immensely. If I didn't have the connection with my cousin that had the precious stone company, I would have never been able to come here with $100 and then start the next day slowly building myself. If I didn't have the connection with the gentleman that partnered up with me that had it in with the vintage watches, I would have never been able to start. So I don't know, if I had moved to Memphis, Tennessee, I don't think I would have been able to have the same success and reach that I have today. I'm lucky in that sense. I'm lucky to be in New York, and I'm lucky to be in a certain community and environment that makes it happen.
So can I ask Guy then? So as a new person moving into this industry, whenever this was, 10 years ago, whatever, how welcoming was the community of other watch dealers to a new guy who was selling suits yesterday and he's selling watches now? How easy was it to transition, even with the connections you had? How was the environment that you settled into with watches? I'm always curious about that.
A good question. Thinking and reminiscing about it now, it was brutal. It was really brutal, because first of all, yeah, I was in the jewelry industry before, but I was dealing with a certain clientele with jewelry stores and high-end designers and precious stone dealers. And there was certain decor. And when I first went to the first watch show here in New York, I was like shocked. The people were completely different. The approach was different. They were like selling. I was shocked to see millions of dollars of sophisticated watches, first of all, thrown into little plastic bags and thrown into a showcase. And then the people were dealing with them as if they were potatoes and tomatoes. It was shocking.
Yeah.
And then also I just came out of nowhere and they were really tough on me. Till slowly I proved myself through honesty and good intentions. Slowly I found my way, but it wasn't a welcoming industry at all. And it's funny you say that. You might know him. One of my top customers in the suits was this gentleman who is a big watch dealer, Michael Safdie. I don't know if you heard of him ever.
Big Yes.
Yeah. So Michael was a really good friend and a customer, and he also transitioned from his prior business to becoming a watch dealer, if not 10, 11 years ago. And I thought he would have been, for example, helpful with me, but also he was very brutal, and it was like a rude awakening that, no, you gotta make your own path in this new adventure. No, nobody's gonna really give me any assistance here. So yeah, it was really tough, even from the people I thought would have been most helpful. It's a world there in the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And thank you for sharing that story, because if you look at on Instagram and a lot of these kind of online watch dealer spheres, it's very performative. It's all great. It's just glamorous life, all of that. But I'm sure the underbelly, the true story is much different. So always nice to hear an honest perspective, because I have to be honest. The only glimpse into that world I have is through the movie Uncut Gems, which was like a panic attack for 2 hours.
Yes.
So I wondered how realistic
that movie
was.
Brutal. brutal to watch. In fact, I only watched it once.
Yeah, do you interact much with the Diamond District?
Yes, totally. As I told you, I started watch business. So I started 20 years ago with my aunt. The office is in the Diamond District. So I beat those roads for 20 years. And then when I came back, I took the booth. Starting the classic watch 10 years ago, the booth was in 32 West 47th Street, right smack in the middle of the block.
Oh, wow.
And Uncut Gems was shot a lot in my exchange. I am in the background there of a few scenes. Like, you can see my shadow, etc. We did meet Adam Sandler, and my kids met him. It was really part of my experience there, the movie Uncut Gems.
Oh, wow.
Do you think it accurately captures the place or not? Or what could it capture more accurately?
It does. It captures the place. It does. It shows you it's a brutal place. There is the glamour, but there is the crude reality. There is all this trust-based business dealings based on a handshake. All these little nooks and places in 47th Street that only if you're an insider you would know of. All these people, they really look out of a movie. It really is like that. I also take pictures of all these people on my other accounts. I photograph them prominently.
Yeah.
They're really characters out of a movie. It really is. So as you said, The location matters. Yes, the location matters. If you're on 47th Street, it makes a huge difference because you're there. People know you. You have access to goods, access to credit, all sorts of help that you wouldn't have. If I don't know if a watch dealer lives in Virginia, I don't think he can do the same things that we would be able to do here. Or have the people selling the stuff, the goods coming from all over the world. It's a special place to be in.
And as the world saw in the movie Uncut Gems, it's also in many ways a very Jewish place. How does Jewish culture influence it?
Jewish culture immensely influenced it because 75% of the characters on the block are Jewish. Either they're Hasidic or come from other places of the world. But It's a very Jewish street. Jewish people have been involved in jewelry, diamonds, and precious items for centuries. Not so much because Jewish people are necessarily rich, but because we always had to have all our assets packed in pocket-size items in case we needed to flee somewhere and to move away. Yes, that's our innate part of our culture, to deal with diamonds, gold, jewelry, etc. And furthermore, since most Jewish people know each other and they're close somehow or related one way or another, there's all this trust-based relationship and handshake dealings that are possible only if, you know, you're in the group, in the community, people know you because you're Jewish.
That's very interesting. There is certainly historical reasons why, you know, Jewish people and other minorities in that sense were forced to work in trade, and whether it's clothing or jewelry or gemstones. Certainly, I grew up in the Soviet Union, and historically, there's a long history of antisemitism and persecution and a policy of excluding Jewish people from professional trades. So doctors, lawyers, engineers, there was always either Jewish people were barred from entering those professions or there were very strict quotas, which then forces the population, and also they were excluded from major centers as well, or major cities. So historically, so that does tend to channel Jewish people and Muslim people and lots of other minorities into trade and making money in bartering or money lending, things that require a different access to the economy. So that's historically, there's real reasons for that as well, for sure. So it's really
interesting. Yeah, likewise. My family were victims of the pogroms that happened over a century ago, but there's this kind of collective memory of all the other episodes of flight and persecution, from Moses to the Inquisition to the Holocaust, to the things that are happening today. Do you think that this collective Jewish memory of flight plays any role in shaping thoughts around collecting?
Absolutely. As I told you, we have always had a need to have our assets in pockets, translated into pocket-sized item, because if you have a building, you can't take your building and run away. If you have stocks, you can't take stocks and run away. But have a diamond ring or a Patek Philippe watch, you can rest assured you can go to another country and it still has value. Collecting precious items such as watches, diamonds, jewelry, gold has much to do with our collective memory of persecution and hiding our wealth somehow from the government or from the people who are out to get us, just because we are who we are. And to this day, that's how I reason myself. I don't invest in stocks. I try not to keep money in the bank, and I try to concentrate everything in things that are tradable, movable, hideable, and always have an intrinsic value to them. And this is why I do what I do, and I collect the watches that I collect. And this is what I try to also promote to my customers. This has been great for centuries, this way of thinking. I mean, nobody ever lost by having a precious item, but people lost their pants with stocks, bank accounts, and all sorts of fictitious assets. This has intrinsic value. And if you notice also, most of my watches are in gold that I sell. Not because just the style, but because the gold value.
Always, gold has done quite nicely over the last few months.
Yes. Absolutely.
We should probably move the conversation probably towards slightly more positive.
My last name, my family is originally from Iran. We're of Iranian descent. And my last name, Gohari, actually means jeweler. So we've been at it for centuries.
Oh, that's very cool. Now, you're a man of many interests as well. So watches and clothing are certainly one aspect of your personality and certainly your work. Another I've noticed, you seem to have very strong affinity for music, particularly jazz. How did that come about? Is that something that you collect as well, whether it's previous guests on the podcast? We had the pleasure of speaking with Todd Levin, and he's involved in the art world, but he collects jazz records, early first pressings and things like that.
Even posts songs.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Good call, Anne. Exactly. So, Guy, does music play a similar role for you? Is it purely pleasure? Is that another avenue of trade or collectability for you as well?
Not yet, although I was exploring that idea. But I started learning jazz during the pandemic. In all my walks there in the empty city, there was this one jazz saxophonist sitting. I kept on encountering him, and I also took many photos of him. And that's how I fell in love with jazz. It was just something new to me, even although I was like 39 years old. I never heard like jazz music much before, or gave it any interest. And I love the fact that there is a sense of individuality in the jazz music, but at the same time, there's a whole quintet or group of musicians playing together, and each one gets his own individual time to shine. I love that because they're all one of many and many of one, and I love that idea. And just inspiring the whole music. And I also noticed it puts a certain atmosphere. When you play the jazz music, it puts you in a certain mood. It gets me in a meditative state. It just elevates the whole vibration of a room to a different level. I didn't get that experience with other types of music. So I
interesting. So in your videos, you often seem to spend...
Yes, tell me. Sorry.
In your videos, you often put a lot of emphasis on setting a mood, of having jazz, of talking about relaxation, wishing good Shabbos. Why does atmosphere matter so much when you're selling watches and displaying new acquisitions? And what sort of atmosphere are you trying to convey?
I'm trying to convey an atmosphere of relief for the viewer, because the moment they see these items, it shouldn't be a time of stress. It should be a time of escape. For me and for the people who are looking at this stuff, it should be a pleasure in life. Although watch collecting in recent years, because of the prices and the hype, etc., items became extremely expensive. And then I believe whoever pursues them has a certain level of stress. I try to take that stress away by making it a time of relief, a time of relaxation. So I try to set the mood, the music. I try to talk in a soothing voice, inspire you to calm down, take a breather, and spend some time together looking at beautiful items. Whether you buy or not, for me, it's irrelevant. I just want to share my passion, and then if it resonates with someone, and someone has the means and desires to go for it, I'm here to help. But otherwise, things come by themselves. I just put my best out there, trying to inspire and make people happy in this way, which is my venue. So that's why I believe it's so important.
Interesting. You also have videos of these outdoor walks where you talk about, for instance, today one about breathing slowly. And there's often a theme as well of relaxation and relief. Why do you think it's so important to remind people about relaxing?
People are so caught up in their material pursuits that they just forget what the salt and important things of life are. And the important thing in life is the right emotion, love, passion, enjoying the time we have here. So I start my day every day. First of all, I go to the synagogue and we pray with the group, etc. And then after that, I go where I take those videos. I spend time about 45 minutes, 1 hour in nature every day. And I just stand there and think, say my thank yous, pray for the world, pray for my own bettering, etc. I found great relief. This is what makes me happy in life. This time, this well-wishing, these good thoughts, these good intentions. So this is what gives me the joy. And I feel if I don't share what gives me the joy, I'm selfish. So that's why I do what I do when I take those videos. Believe me, it's out of my comfort zone. Also, the speeches I give, etc. It's difficult for me, but I feel selfish if I don't do this, because I found a certain level of happiness and joy in life through this way. If I don't tell you about it, I feel like I'm stealing. So that's why I try to incorporate it even in my job. Both things have nothing to do with each other, but they have at the same time everything to do with each other, because I can only be myself.
How does material culture intersect with spiritual culture? Because you've got two Instagram accounts. You've got one, Mario 55, which is about material culture in many ways. It's about watches, to a lesser extent, about Ralph Lauren and gems. Yeah. And then you've got a second account, Rio Light, which is, it's about the parashat. You're basically giving a small sermon each week about the weekly Torah portion and explaining what it means to you in a kind of a more current context. How do the two balance?
The two balance, they're of course both extremes, spirituality and materialism, but living a balanced, healthy life is the combination of both. Who said that to be spiritual, you have to live a rudimental life? And who said that if you like nice things, you can't be spiritual? As a matter of fact, even in the material pursuit, I find the spirituality, and in spirituality, I find the material pursuit. It's about really bridging heaven and earth at that point through you being a human being. I am an angel, and at the same time, I'm an animal. You know what I'm saying? I'm both at the same time, and it's okay. And this is what I came here to do. We didn't come here to be monks on a mountain and fast all day. We didn't come even at the same time here to eat hamburgers and ice cream 24/7. But the balance of both is the healthiest way, I believe. So,
the Dalai Lama has a very nice watch collection. You can be a Tibetan monk and still collect watches.
There you go. Absolutely. And I believe he's doing the right thing, because why not? These things are here. If those things, material things, do bring you joy, then why not? But if your joy is solely based on those things, then that's where the mistake starts, because you never feel really fulfilled. And as you both guys are collector, and I'm also at core a collector, I'm my biggest customer. So we all know the best watch is the next watch. It never ends. It never ends, of course. There's always another one. But our fulfillment shouldn't come through this, because we'll never feel fulfilled. But these things can bring us happiness.
And sometimes people seem to want a grail a little bit too much. Does the second commandment against idolatry address collecting at all? And how do we avoid having our watches become idols?
There's the commandment against coveting someone else's property, his wife, his donkey, etc. It says in the Ten Commandments. That translates to any material item he may have. Coveting someone else's possession, being jealous, that's a problem. Wanting to achieve the same, that's a great pursuit. But other than that, there's no problem in those material pursuits. Again, if the material pursuit becomes your idol, that's a problem. If money is your God, you miss the point. All these, money is just a means to an end, not the end all be all. The end all be all is our growth, our giving to this world, etc. Money is just the way to pursue these actions. So, but it shouldn't be our religion, or material items shouldn't be our priority. Making a difference in people's life and doing the right thing, correcting ourselves, that should be our priority.
It's very interesting. It is very interesting. I must confess, I don't tend to think of these things quite on the same frequency as you, in terms of I'm less spiritual than you in that sort of sense. But I certainly understand the pursuit of inner peace versus material, pursuing material things. I totally understand that. I was just going to say, I find it very hard to watch your video about slow breathing, which tends to proceed, like the videos I like the most of you when you just show what's on your table or on your desk at work. And it's very hard because sometimes you put stuff. I notice my breathing gets faster. Show some of the good stuff you've got on your desk. But it is fun. Look, I totally get I get what you mean, though, about the different aspects of
So we've talked about the whole covetousness aspect, but are there any other parts of the Torah, the Talmud, that speak at all to collecting or the appreciation of art or jewels or things of that nature?
Not really. For example, when in the Torah it speaks about building the tabernacle and then the sanctuary, etc., it wasn't just a simple place. It was filled and packed with gold and weavings and colors and precious metals and silver, etc. So the pursuit of beauty within a spiritual realm is totally there, even in the scripture. Many Jews, Orthodox Jews, miss that point. They think that to be the best Jew or the spiritual person, you have to live a black and white life. And they all wear black suits and white shirts, and they think living in a simple home, that's the goal. But it's not so. As again, relating to the answer of the question before, beauty and spirituality are intrinsically connected. You will find God in beautiful places. You will find God in a beautiful panorama or garden or building. You will find God in a beautiful woman. It's not that necessarily spirituality is void of all those things. Absolutely the opposite. But what is taught in the Talmud is the pursuit, the extra, again, emphasis on material pursuit and putting away money, etc., the whole being like that's seen in a negative light. Again, just means to an end, not...
Yes, a Buddha learned through his hard journey to pursue a middle path of neither decadence nor austerity, because there were issues with both, and then he arrived somewhere at the middle after going on this long life path of experiencing things in the world. But going back to Jewish culture, is there anything about the culture or history that has influenced you to particularly celebrate the vintage rather than the new, to appreciate what was made a generation before us?
I learned the appreciation for older things from my grandfather, Yehuda. He lived in Israel. He was the first collector I ever met in my life. As a kid, he always showed me his collection of coffee table books, and he was a painter and an artist as well. And he collected all sorts of things. In a way, he was also a hoarder. But I saw the difference. He taught me the difference between old world made item and a new world made item. To me, all these modern items, watches or anything, feel so soulless, feel without a soul. They feel clinical, sterile. I don't know. I just cannot connect to them for some reason. Even the clothing that I wear, like all these Ralph Lauren things, they're all 30, 20 years old. I rarely buy new items. I just like things that have a soul into them, a history. But it doesn't have necessarily to do anything with Jewish culture. It just has to do with it, you know, each person's personality. But also my father, on the other side, he loved also style, etc. But we never had an appreciation for older style, older things. It just came, I don't know, my father, God rest, bless his soul, he passed away. He was quite shocked I love all these old things. He never quite understood. But I think they have an extra flavor. It's irrepeatable.
It's interesting because when we look at the watches that you sell, particularly if we pivot towards watches that you tend to showcase in your professional capacity, you tend to specialize in dress watches and time only dress without complications most of the time. There's a few exceptions like that Spectacular, Cartier, Skeleton, Pocket Watch, Minute Repeater. Is there a particular reason why you gravitated towards time only dress watches, vintage time only dress watches? Is there is it a purpose, or was it just something that you wear?
When I first started 10 years ago, we were, together with my partner at the time, we were selling, of course, what we liked, but it was a lot of vintage Rolex, and we had actually started the whole Royal Oak and Nautilus vintage pieces at the time. Nobody was quite buying them back then.
Okay.
Then one day I came across Ronnie Madvani's Instagram, and I was like,
oh yes,
flabbergasted. I've never seen watches like this in my life. I said, wow, these are the watches that I like. This is for me. And liking what he had, I started looking for those kind of items. I said, bah, maybe I can sell them to him. So I did find a couple of pieces like that. And we did form some sort of a relationship at the time. I sold him 1, 2, 3 Audemars Piguet's form watches. And I saw that I was more successful with those, and I had more satisfaction, less competition, more individuality, more traction, and also more profits, because the items were unknown and there's no quite real value or comparative items that you can say, hey, I saw this. It's just, they're all like unique watches.
Mm.
That's why I started selling what I sell. And then I started embodying this kind of path, and these are the watches that I also buy and collect for my own personal collection. I truly believe in what I sell. I can't sell a watch that I don't like. I would be lying to the customer. And I can't sell a watch that is too expensive. I feel I would be doing a disservice, because there are three factors that motivate me when I'm buying and proposing an item. Number one, it has to have value, meaning it cannot be crazy expensive. Number two, it has to be unique. And number three, it has to have a lot of flair and character that when you wear the watch, nobody else can have the same thing, and you will only get compliments and you will come for more and more. So that's my strategy in my offering and buying.
Ah, very good. Great philosophy. And once again, huge shout out to Ronnie Madvani, friend of the show, previous guest. And I'm sure Ronnie's Instagram account has ruined many a lives and many a marriage, because the stuff he showcases there is just so desirable and so cool. And yeah, just very unique, very distinctive. Oh, that makes perfect sense. Absolutely.
Those watches typically,
given the low
production
numbers of these older.
Yeah. Those watches, sorry, typically weren't expensive in principle. So there's all, I'm always of the philosophy of more watches, more fun, not that one grail big watch. And Ronnie kind of goes for that philosophy too. He likes to have multiple watches, multiple fun. He's not going to buy a $100,000 watch. He'd rather buy 10 watches of $10,000.
Sure.
And that's one of the pillars of my collection, just lower value, lower, not crazy item, crazy grail items, but unique items.
Yeah. Yeah. And
how do you determine pricing?
Good question.
They're so unique.
Good question. Typically based on what I pay for them, not necessarily that I buy something for three and I say, okay, this could be worth 20,000. I try to give on the deal that I got if I did get one. Otherwise, just feeling, a 35 millimeter watch cannot be the same price of a 33 millimeter watch. An automatic watch cannot be the same as a manual wine or quartz watch, etc. Desirable design, desirable shape, desirable size, all factors that make a final value on a price, on a watch that doesn't have real set price out there in the marketplace. It has to make sense somehow. The same watch, I can say,
is this like selling gems?
Yes, it's exactly like selling gems, because there is no set price in a precious colored gem. It's all by comparison. There is this nice ruby that weighs 5 carat and has this color. And let's compare it to this other ruby, which is 4 carat and lighter and duller. So if this 5 carat is 20,000, then this 4 carat has to be 12,000. It's all by comparison. But ultimately then, like gems, one guy can say, oh, I think this is worth 50. Another guy says, I hate it, it's worth 10. It's just so unique. And that's why I love what I do, because it's just gray. It's an illusion-based game. And this is what my father taught me. We were selling precious stone. He's like, guy, it's all about illusions. If I show the stone, it's one illusion. And if John Doe shows the stone, it's a different illusion. And I may show the stone and the customer hates it. And John Doe comes with all his British flair and accent, and the stone looks 100 times better in the eye of the beholder. Same here. Someone showed maybe the same item that I showed, but it does not, it's a different illusion. So that's why I love what I do. It's exciting.
And that's really interesting to me. Yeah, it's really interesting to me because I don't tend to collect vintage watches at all. I tend to go more towards the sort of the independently made, the artisanal made, if you like, watches. That's my passion. And that's, I always find the vintage watch world a little bit strange in that sense, because there's no rules and it's mostly personality driven, dealer personality driven. So I find that very, to me, that's a bit unsettling in a sense of not quite knowing what the prices mean or what the condition, even the way people describe condition is different as well. So I always find that very interesting. But the stuff that you talked about in terms of lower pricing, if we can use lower in inverted commas, but really cool pieces. Some of my favorite watches that you've recently posted was these Pierre Cardin pieces, I think from about 1970s with the Le Coultre movements, but these amazing cases, these kind of space-age case designs. They're some of the coolest watches I remember seeing anywhere. And there's around the, I think it was $1,500 or whatever it was. And they were just amazing, to me, amazing value if you're into, if you're looking for a cool piece, that's that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. And then also the thing that I love in the product that I sell, that unlike all these GMTs, Royal Oaks, and all those models that do have a set market price, it's not the $500 or the $1,000 up and down that makes a difference. If you like the watch that I sell, it's for your personal enjoyment. It's not like a blue chipping. It's just these items that I sell are really, either they bring you joy or they don't. Either you want or not. Like, it's not the 500, 1,000 more up and down that's going to make the difference. And that's why it's exciting. And I think it's exciting also for the buyer himself. Sure. Nobody can raise a question.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So can I ask then, Guy, who is your customer base? Is it, do you sell mostly to clients? Do you sell mostly to industry or to other dealers? I'm always curious, what's kind of your mix percentage-wise? Is it directly to people or to industry or to other dealers? If we can
ask. A little bit of both. Mainly I sell, I think, to private collectors through the Instagram, through my website, through Chrono24 and eBay. And then, of course, I sell to my colleagues and other dealers that might like my product or want to give it a try. I sell to jewelry stores that have a special customer for one of my items. Yeah, most of my business is to sell 65% collectors and the rest within the industry. I don't discriminate. One thing that I was a shocker for me, by the way, from the jewelry industry that I was before, is that in the watch, collector, private, or dealer, the difference is very slim. Everybody just wants to sell the watch. It doesn't matter. There's not a special pricing if you come as a dealer, really, or you come as a collector. The gap is minimized. You should know it as a collector. You can come with confidence. It's not that a dealer has much more buying power than anybody else. And furthermore, with the Instagram, it's the playing field has been totally leveled. Everybody's in the same game. Everybody just wants to sell. Doesn't matter, I come or you come. No special pricing. And it's okay. It's a democratic world now.
So what differentiates dealers?
What differentiates them is that if I know a dealer, then dealer might be able to perhaps inspect the watch and has the watch on consignment, where a private collector wouldn't have that chance. Just because we don't know each other. There's that trust base that we were talking about before, the 47th Street. Among dealer, we have. So yeah, that's the only added value. But many dealers...
That makes sense.
...sell to dealers. So again, they prefer to sell. They have an illusion on the collector. I just want to sell whoever comes.
Fair enough. And whoever's listening to this, definitely go and check out Guy's stuff. It's very cool. Lots of different processes. So let me ask you then slightly different question, Guy. As a collector as well and as accumulator, how do you decide what sells and what stays? How do you decide what you take something in? How do you decide, well, that's definitely for me, I'm keeping that versus I'm selling that tomorrow? What do you have a criteria in your mind? Is it value? Is it brand? Or is it just whatever?
The watches I kept were the ones that I felt I wasn't able to find again and or had very good value that I said, okay, there's no point in selling it today or tomorrow. You can keep it. It's always a good deal. Those were the two factors in my keeping the watches. I built up a nice little collection of Cartier vintage pieces. And I built a little collection Audemars Piguet and Patek Philippe pieces from the 70s with the ultra-thin automatic movements. Those are the watches that I love the most. The automatic Pateks and Audemars that they share the same caliber, 2-1, and the one on the Nautilus and the Royal Oak. Mm-hmm. I like watches that utilize these movements. That's my preferred style.
Oh, interesting. No, that's very cool. And can I ask something? And I'm always curious about with dealers or with people who handle watches professionally. Are you the type of personality that attaches emotions to pieces? So, you know, so you would keep a watch because it reminds you of a time you were in Paris or a time you met your wife or the time you made a deal. Do you attach meaning to individual watches or is it purely based on what I like and what value will hold? And even if I have to sell tomorrow, I know I can get more money for it later on, even in your own piece. Like, how do you approach collecting emotionally?
Initially, yes. I want to share with you that my first watch was a Rolex Datejust that my father gifted me at 20 years old.
My first major watch was a 16234.
The same one, 16234, exactly, with a silver Roman dial, non-luminous. He actually traded 10-carat cabochon ruby for the Rolex the jeweler.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we made very well on the trade at the time. I still remember to this day. So that was my first good watch and my most cherished item. And I gifted it then to my wife when we had our first boy. And my second watch... I wasn't a watch dealer still. It was another Rolex Datejust, different, with a tuxedo dial that my wife bought me for the engagement. So I wanted to continue with this kind of vibe whenever I did buy a watch. So I bought a watch when I finished my first tractate of the Talmud. I have a watch that I remember that commemorates that. Mm-hmm. And then when I started my own company, Classic 55, I bought a watch to remember that time. But then, thank God, things started getting better and better and I started buying more watches and then didn't quite have any emotional meaning other than that, taking advantage of an opportunity and tucking away some savings into a watch.
Sure.
But initially, yes, totally emotionally motivated. And of my own watches, I look forward... As the Patek Philippe ad, passing it on to the next generation, the motivation is that. Is I want each of my four children to know that they have a little treasure, a little collection of watches waiting for them. Each can walk away with a couple of things. And if they ever need to sell, start a life, whatever they need to do, they can maybe think that they have that in their back pocket. That was my main motivation.
Interesting.
So I have two kids, and I've collected almost a, it's called a duplicated collection, where there are often two watches that are very similar. And I figure, oh, I can give one to one kid, the other to the other kid. Have you thought about how you would split them up among the four, or has that influenced your collecting at all?
Each kid's certain watches, so I hope no arguments. One day, they can take what they like.
Hey, as a parent, I'm sure you've got a favorite kid. The favorite kid gets the best watches. The second favorite kid gets the second lot favorite watches. The third favorite kid just gets the Swatch watches or whatever you have, and the fourth kid just gets disappointed. That's the traditional way of doing it. That's how fairy tales divide it. That's the way to do it.
I have three daughters and one son. Maybe who knows?
They can find it.
We'll have the upper hand.
But being given the family name that you have, Gahari, is there a extra pressure, and we use pressure in inverted commas, for the kids to, you know, take over the family trade in a sense, because you're second, third, whatever generation jeweler you are, if we consider watch selling as jewelry, do you think, would you want your kids to stay in the same industry, or do you think is this too bruising, too brutal, let them enjoy themselves and have an easier life?
Honestly, I would love them to join the industry. I would love my son to work with me one day.
There you go.
I would love to. And it's important in our religion to have a job that is comfortable and not that we're not working in the fields, or like we need to have a certain level of comfort to be able to pursue our material pursuits too. This is something that I learned from Michael Safdie himself. He's also, you should know, he also has a whole spiritual following, and he gives classes, etc. And he always told me, Guy, we have to choose a job that we're at ease, we have the right amount of time, we have free time, we're not like 6 a.m. to 10 p.m. working. Even though the industry could be harsh, and feelings could be hurt, and pockets also, I think nonetheless it's a good world to be in, you know, that can ensure a good living and comfort and all sorts of good things.
Yeah, interesting. Fingers crossed.
It's always good to hear.
Yes. I really feel truly blessed.
How do you source your watches? That's the most important thing. There's something about living the life you want to live that is priceless.
All those morning meditations, not always life is easy, and I have had many ups and downs. And don't get me wrong, in the 10 years of business in the watch industry, I've seen many harsh times. Not always the business was pumping. I've had difficulties, but those times of prayers, meditation, etc., did manifest into this dream that I had of pursuing my passion and having a comfortable life. So through the dark times, then come the good times. I feel truly blessed to be able to do all the things that I do while doing what I love at the same time.
That's really interesting. And once again, thank you for the honesty. It's good when people talk about the reality rather than it's all gloss and glitter and glamour. So I guess the question I had was, what's really interesting to me now is we've come through, so we're recording this in January 2023. We've had a period, probably most of last year particularly, but even before that, where the watch industry was very buoyant. Prices were high, lots of confidence. All of that, even through the pandemic, people had more money to spend because they weren't traveling and things like that. Now there is a bit of an economic downturn. There's the war in Ukraine. The cost of living is going up. There is less confidence in the markets, I would say. Have you noticed that impacting the vintage watch market and the people that you deal with, or has that not been as bad as I'm thinking it might be?
I've noticed when the business started going great prior and during and after the pandemic, and clearly now I see the bend in the market and the correction. But again, thank God I deal in the product that I deal, which is unique and different and then not so comparable. So it hasn't been really affected. The price. It's not that the watch that I bought for 10 now is worth 6. The watch that I bought for 10 is still worth 10 or more because it's a unique item. If you like it, you're going to go for
right.
But yeah, wow, I've seen quite the roller coaster. Quite the roller coaster. My hope and wish, don't get me wrong, I would love to see it back to the levels of in pricing of when I started. And when I started, a Rolex Daytona, for example, 6263 was 20,000-30,000, which is big money, but not 50-100. It's stressful to deal in this kind of amounts. And Patek Philippe Nautilus was...
Why is it stressful? Is it stressful? You'd think that you'd need fewer transactions to make a certain amount of money if the transaction values are larger.
No, you'll be surprised to know that in the watch business, your profits are much larger on smaller items than on big ticket items. The $50,000 watch, the margin is probably you're going to make, I don't know, anywhere be 5 to maximum 15% because the price is so set. There's so many comparables. But on the $5,000 watch, percentage could be much higher, 30%. There's no set price. Big ticket items are stressful. Also, there could be a mistake. There could be something that is not original. Then if before your risk was X, now your risk is Y, it's so much more stressful. If before the risk was 20, now it's 50 and you made a mistake, you're losing your pants.
Right.
All it takes in this...
Some more diversification.
All it takes in this Instagram world is for, on those big watches, one guy to say something is wrong, then it's done. So.
Yes. Yes, true.
I just hope it goes back to the simplicity of back then. And it was so much more fun and people were buying watches because they liked them, not because it represents any kind of status symbol or hype or show off. It was just all about passion. And passion is not inherently connected to money, just passion.
Yeah, of course. Of course. And with regards to sourcing of watches, I guess the question I had was, where do you tend to source your watches broadly? You're not going to give us your trade secrets, of course, and we're not asking for those. So where do you source most of your watches? And has the downturn in the market affected your ability to source watches as well?
I source watches from all sorts of venues. Of course, the regular one, auction houses, Sotheby's, Christie's. I also attend the auctions and I try to find the items that are unique and less of hit by the public.
Yeah, of course.
I love to buy on eBay. One of my favorite venues is eBay. I love
it. You're a brave man.
Extraordinary. For 10 years, I love it. You can pay with a credit card. I bought millions, believe me. Maybe I had a problem once. It's pretty safe.
Oh, wow. Okay.
I love to buy also on Chrono 24. And a lot of watches that I have come from private collections. Thank God I established a certain amount of trust and relationships with my clients. So they do entrust me with their possessions. So I'm lucky in that sense. In the past 2 years, there's been a lot of that, a lot of consignments directly from the privates who have been owning these items for many years, and now it's time to move on and simmer down. So I've had a lot of these
opportunities. You recently had some watches from Ronnie as well, from Ronnie Madvani, some amazing stuff that you're handling. Yeah, which is a great set of stuff.
Yes. For example, Ronnie has been consigning me watches for a bunch of years. And then dealing in the product, in the recognizable product that I deal in, whenever a watch like this surfaces on the block of 47th Street, the first person they call typically is me for that kind of watch. dress gold, right. Patek Philippe or the Mar Piguet or the Cartier. I'm the first person that comes to mind, thank God. And also jewelry stores.
That makes sense.
Yeah, once it's they see the, what you're dealing with, then people start coming with that kind of product. I get a lot of Instagram messages of people wanting to sell or consign. They know what I like. So that's how I procure the goods.
Guy, can I ask you a question?
Me, always preferred consignment is the best way for me because, first of all, I have the time and I don't have the stress and pressure of putting my funds into the item. And typically those watches come with good pedigree. So that's the most appreciated form of procuring watch, a consignment, a good old consignment.
Ah, interesting. Interesting. No, that what I was going to ask is, I've always wanted to be a fly on the wall when a call goes from one dealer to another dealer. So if you could entertain us, so let's say a watch comes into a jewelry store or somebody else in the diamond district and they go, oh, this watch, Guy would love it. It's definitely his. So if I'm the dealer ringing you to sell you the watch, am I naming the price I want you to pay or am I saying, this is what I've got, how much are you going to pay me?
Who shoots first?
Yeah, that's why I've always wanted to know that, if you can share.
Oh, yeah, I would love to share with you real life situations. For example, I'm friendly with many of my colleagues, of course, so I'm sure Adam Golden from Menta Watches. So he also has many relationships around. They offer him maybe my style of watch. So he directly thinks of me, sends me the WhatsApp image of the watch, asking me, what are we paying? So I'm giving him based on my experience and comparable. And then he might buy the watch and he sends me the watch. And here we are, guy, go sell. Or I hate when people, that if he does it, it's fine. But if a jewelry store calls me like, what are you paying? I always like, your watch, your price. And then, of course, I try
to
buy it.
Yeah, it's what I want to know. Yeah, of course.
Yeah,
your
watch, your price.
But usually they say, but if they do name the price, so let's say it's if a dealer tries to sell it to you, right? If they say, I don't know, let's say 10,000, right? Do you think their actual price that they're willing to sell is 5,000 or is it 7,000? What's the starting negotiation price and how far down can you push it? I understand it varies, but I'm always curious. What's the leeway in the industry?
If they start 10,000 and I know the watch is worth 5, I directly say, thanks, not for me. So if they're motivated to sell, they know they're trying to pull a fast one. They say, okay, so how much? So then I give them the $5,000 offer, and then we settle somewhere in between that is fair. Or many people, we are pretty transparent with each other too. They say, it costs me X. Can you give me 10%, 5%, or $500, whatever it's worth it for him to move it along?
Okay.
It's pretty transparent.
That makes sense.
When it comes dealer to dealer, we try to be somewhat helpful.
Yeah, it's a fascinating world because once again, I'm in Melbourne. I'm very much removed from that world of New York, certainly. But even in the Australian watch dealer trade, we don't have, or diamond trade for that matter, we don't have the volume and the concentration of dealers that the diamond district in New York has, the few blocks that all cry together. So that world is very fascinating to me. So thank you for answering
my
question.
The beauty in all this is that, and this is my hope every day, it could happen that we get the score of our lifetime any day. Something can come in and person is willing to sell.
I hear you.
Especially in the watches I get very few people would know what the heck it is. In the Cartier vintage world, it's all that. They don't know what these things are worth. But they're starting to get it.
No, I'm finding the Cartier thing is really interesting because this is my uninformed opinion, but prices were going high. They were crazy high. And now they've, I feel, turned the corner because they went beyond even what people who are generally enthusiastic about vintage Cartier are prepared to venture, maybe. I could be wrong, but that seems to be my uninformed impression, that prices are...
Yeah, they never made any sense to me.
Yeah, it's coming back to reality. Luckily, it's exciting when they start jumping in price, but then the buyers don't come. Things, big buyers come when things are reasonable. When a Santos Dumont, for example, costed $3,000 4 years ago, and today it's $8,000. How many buyers can we have that are willing to spend $8,000 on that?
Sure.
When the choices are many.
Sure. Yes. Yeah, it's interesting.
So, yeah, hopefully everything comes back. I'm not one of those dealers that tries to pump the market. I try to keep it reasonable. I'd like everybody to get a deal.
That's good. You're my kind of dealer.
Because
we're talking to you now.
You've talked a lot about your philosophy as a dealer. No, sir.
I want to say I'm not selling to a client. It's not a one-time deal that I have in mind.
Yeah, sure.
The person who's buying the watch for me today might come back 1 year later and say, hey, I want to sell the watch, and he consigns me the watch. It has to make sense value-wise for me to sell it again. So always keeping the market reasonable is the goal.
Sure.
So we've talked a lot about your philosophy as a dealer. What lessons from your personal philosophy can our collector audience use to improve their lives?
Tricky question, Adam. Just follow your heart, buy what you like when it comes to collecting. Buy what gives you the joy. Buy what doesn't make you stress. If a purchase is too high, the value is too high and it stresses you, don't go for it. I think everybody should have a balance, find their balance in their personal life and in their material pursuit or collecting or job or whatever they do. Follow their heart, follow their passion, and at the same time, keep a level head, keep the head on the shoulders. And don't think I have a great answer for that question.
I think it's beautifully said. Follow your heart, follow your passion is always the right answer in whatever it is. So whatever it is you do. One of the things we should talk about before we wrap up, is photography, because once again, you are a one-man Instagram industry, if we can say. You have a dedicated Instagram account for your photography. So Murillo Pics, people should check out. Maybe tell us a little bit about what you tend to put on there and how you go about getting the shots that you do.
I started taking those pictures about 5-6 years ago in 47th Street of those characters that I would encounter there every day that looked, as we said before, out of the Uncut Gems movie. And every day I would come and take a picture of them in their outfit in that location. And I started collecting them. As I'm collecting watches, I'm also collecting pictures of people. And also on the walk to work there, I would encounter every day the same people in the same location. The surround, the light is different every day. The outfit is different. So I started finding interest in documenting this Groundhog Day type of life and situations that were happening in New York. And then all of a sudden the pandemic hit, and as everybody stayed home, I couldn't stay home. I can't. I have a hard time. So I started going to the office every day nonetheless, even though the city was closed. I was like the only person on the train and the only person walking on Fifth Avenue. And I was like shocked to see the city the way it was. And I started taking pictures. Yeah,
wow. It was empty.
Yeah, it was empty. It was naked. So I started taking pictures of this nakedness that I kept on seeing around me. And furthermore, I kept on encountering these surreal things, like the library on Fifth Avenue, the lions all of a sudden had masks on them. Who the heck put the masks on the lion? But it was like
an atlas.
Art installation, but not. I didn't know if it was an official thing or not. But I started taking pictures of them, and then they had the signs changing. And all those things. And then we have the Titan and Rockefeller with the mask. So I took all those pictures, and then I kept on sharing them with my family on Instagram, and you know, I had great passion for it. And I said to my son, I would dream to make a book. And he said, and my son now is almost 10 years old. He said, Dad, why don't you do that? So I wanted to prove my son that dreams do happen if you pursue them. So I worked on the project, collected all the pictures, and then published and printed this little book, New York Naked, which documents New York City during the corona pandemic, its emptiness, its nakedness, and all those weird characters that came up there. And that was just the greatest thing, the thing that I want to show my son, that imprint, that you believe in something, it can happen. Now, that it is a commercial success or not, it doesn't matter. I pursued my dream. I did what I wanted. Here it is. And it's for people to enjoy if they want. So that's that great. Morello picture.
And we should just say to people,
great passion for.
Yeah. And we should tell people who are listening, if you want to check out, and for everyone listening, if you want to check out Guy's photography, definitely go at Instagram, Morello Pics. And there's a link to Guy's book, New York Naked, through Instagram. If you listen to this at work, do not Google New York Naked just straight out. Go through it through Instagram, because we cannot guarantee what you'll find if you just Google New York Naked. But definitely go through the Instagram, the Morello Pics, and there's the blurb link there. But yeah, definitely check it out. That's cool. I love hearing about people who have other hobbies and other passions, and they pursue them alongside the watch stuff. Because I think horology, because I think it adds another dimensionality to the hobby. You get to appreciate every hobby, every interest we appreciate. We bring these outside perspectives. So if you're into horology, but you're also into photography, you'll get to see the watches and the clocks and things in a different light. No pun intended there. It's great. It's really cool. I'm very jealous of that, because that's not how my brain works, particularly photography, but I'm very great. Yeah, very cool that you shared your story. That's great.
Thank you so much. For me, it all has to do with passion and passion for life and doing what you love, whether it's photography, watches, whether it's fashion. Mm. Things that bring you solace and relief are things that are worth living for.
Beautifully said.
So are there any Instagram accounts that we should follow to see people that are passionate about things or things that will bring us solace and relief?
I think Ronnie Madvani's account brings solace and relief to thousands of people. And one account that has nothing to do with watches that I really like the energy, and it has been a role model for me in my business pursuits. I don't know if you know this character from Milan, Lino Yeluzzi. He has an account on Instagram at Lino Yeluzzi Official, 460,000 followers, and he's the owner of a clothing boutique, menswear boutique in Milan. He's been a fashion icon there for 40 years. His Instagram is truly worth checking, because it's really what we just spoke about, passion for life, sharing the happiness and the good vibe. Every day he wishes a buongiorno, and he appraises the weather, and he wishes happy birthday to the list he's given. This is what social media is about, showing truly who you are with good intention, good heart, showcasing your talents, sharing it with everyone, having fun while at it. I think then people trust
just
you, like
spell
you,
it for
and
me
will
again.
Be drawn to you. Lino, L-I-N-O, I'm going to write it here in our thing, Yeluzzi Official, at Lino Yeluzzi Official.
LINOIELUZIOFICIAL.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yes, got it now. Yep, yeah. Oh, wow.
That works.
Cool. Very nice. Thank you. That's a great recommendation. Wasn't following that. Maybe I'll send my birthday's coming up.
He's one of the last true icons of the old world, because in our current times, in Instagram, in the Instagram world, the gap is so bridged between me and everybody in the world. But back in the day, if you wanted to buy something, you had to go to a special boutique. You had to go to a special place. It's only in this place in the world. Like, the stuff he sells, it can be only found in his store in Milan and be bought from him. You can't buy it online, this and that. So I love that. I love that. We don't have that anywhere else anymore. So it's something I cherish and I keep to hope to keep alive. And that kind of flavor I hope to give too. This stuff you can find only here and you can only buy it from me. Like that kind of vibe I try to convey.
Yeah. No, very cool. That's a great recommendation. What about you, Adam? Anything relevant?
Oh, thank you. So I was thinking of Mr. Enthusiast. He's not exactly the newest discovery, but MisterEnthusiast, because there's a certain kind of a funkiness, 70s watches, lots of Patek Philippe and Rolex, but of a more classical era. And so I thought, oh, this would be fun to share with people because it has a somewhat similar vibe, although in some ways this feels more 70s, 80s to me. And yes. Roman?
Phil shares similar vibe.
Yes. All right. I will try to match you guys. I've got a bit of a niche account that I'm going to, so it's an Instagram account as well. Now, I don't collect vintage, but I really look to see what would really fit guys' aesthetic or interest. So I found an account. It's quite a small account, only 715 followers, but hopefully we can grow it to at least 720 by the end of this recording. It's Aaron_co-op_. So it's Aaron_COP_. So Aaron is a collector of vintage Vacheron Constantin pieces.
Oh, wow.
He's got 47 of them and counting. So, Guy, you know what? I'm sure you can help him out to round that number up if you. But once again, it's this really cool thing. I'm always very grateful when I find these sort of people who have a particular thing they're pursuing, like particular aesthetic or a particular interest, and they're really taking a really deep dive. So I was very excited when I found Aaron's account, because I thought it would fit sort of Guy's aesthetic and the vintage vibe, but also this nice photography, really cool curated collection. So I hope you enjoy that.
Aaron, yeah, I'm looking at it indeed. Yes. As a matter of fact, we corresponded last week with Aaron, so I know who you're talking
about. Oh, okay. There you go. I trust you to know. I thought I'd pick a niche one, but you're way ahead of me as always, Guy. But that's good. Just shows you what a good dealer of vintage stuff you are. Your people. But look, Guy's been such a pleasure to have you join Adam and I and have a chat about your many passions. And I think it's been a really interesting discussion about spirituality, appreciating craftsmanship and vintage and the multidimensionality of aesthetics and pursuing beauty. So thank you so much for coming to join us. It's been a real pleasure to get to know you.
Yes, it's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Adam. Thank you so much for having me. It's been a real pleasure to have a chat and share whatever I could. I'm really grateful.
Oh, it's been great. And finally, the last thing we always say at the end of each episode, with Fifth Wrist, we set this up as a platform by enthusiasts and for enthusiasts. So if you're listening to this, if you want to join us, contribute, write reviews, or even come on the show and talk with us, please get in touch. We're very open, very welcoming. Follow Fifth Wrist on Facebook and Instagram or on our website at fifthwrist.com. You can subscribe to the podcast and leave us a review. You know what to do. Follow me. I'm at TimesRomanAU. My valiant co-host Adam is at Medium Watch, and our guest Guy is at Marillo55 and ClassicWatchNY.com. And also make sure you check out Guy's other Instagram account at MarilloPix for New York street photography, and check out his photography book as well. Thank you for joining us, and stay on time.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Fifth Wrist is by the community for the community. We would love you to join the crew via our group chat on Slack. Email us at contact@fifthwrist.com and join the movement.